section86.com. We're changing the world of podcasting one show at a time.
Some days I feel like I got my teeth firm on the curb, lying belly up in a gutter somewhere. This wear and this tear, it's just not fucking fair. I wonder if things will get better someday, like on the day I walked away, I walked away, I walked. I'll put a gun to it. If it don't change its ways real goddamn soon. You see, my thoughts are on the loose, and I ain't got shit to lose. Around my neck burn is this noose, and I'm closer, closer to the edge, closer to the edge. Live today.
Hey, this is Reverend Funk from Dean Radio. Listen to White Trash Revival with Donnie fucking Cash.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the White Trash Revival. I am your host, Donnie fucking Cash, and this is episode 32. As you folks know, I am now part of the Section 86 family. I'd like to thank Andy over there for welcoming me aboard with open arms. Well, to start off the show, I did a little song called Broken Man by my buddy Dogbite Harris, and he is from Oregon, and it is off of his album, and I must say it's a good album that I really do dig. It is called Useless and Alone. And here's a little something neat about old Dogbite Harris. He was Bob Wayne's merchandise guy. How fucking awesome is that? And I'm going to be doing a interview with Old Dog Bite here on probably episode 34. Yeah, 34. Next week, I will have Kyle Turley on the show. What the fuck? Am I big time now or what? Who knows? I just enjoy doing what I'm doing, goddammit. I got a great show lined up for us. I got an interview with Pete Berwick. You know, great singer from Chicago. And I'm going to do a album review for Hellbound Glory. Yes, they have a new album out. And before I get in this first set, I'd like to send another fuck you to the Old Oak Revival. Y'all can suck my dick. All right. With all that being said, let's get in this first set.
Once again in this ballroom, all my friends sit waiting patiently. So set us up, bartender, let's get started. Bring around for these three chairs. I heard crying soft and gentle at my table. See the faces in the barroom staring at me. And as I look on down, there are teardrops on the ground. Bring around and me. Hello, barstool, you sure do look lonely. You can join us if you need some company. But all we ask is that you miss her like we. Bring around for these three chairs and me. Hello, barstool, you sure do look lonely. You can join us if you company, but all we ask is that you miss her like we do, and bring around for these three chairs and me.
Thumping. You say you don't need no preaching man. Well, I'm here to tell you the Lord has sent me to do all that I can. The devil wants me drinking. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
The devil, he wants me smoking. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen. The devil wants me carousing and rebel rousing and running around with the pretty little girls in the pretty little skirts. Oh, can I get an amen? Amen.
Amen.
sound of this honest man. Apple and a pipe in a sawdust hand. Always inside of impossible plans. Travel in the night in this homeless van. A perfect description of a sit-down guy. Worst idea is a battle cry. I got a sneaking suspicion of where you are. Your hearty laugh, it travels far. Patiently whittles his horn to toot. He's a blissed out Buddha with a Gouda fruit shoot. Looking for the night in his moldy suit. Worn down souls never taking root. A perfect description of a sit down guy. Worst ideas.
They say that woman was the original sin. It was not Adam who ate from the sinful tree. Though it was a sweet-talking woman, a curvaceous woman with disco in her soul. She had disco in her soul. And she had a little bit of rock and roll. And so Adam, he partook of that forbidden fruit. Though his Lord had told him, nay.
I'm writing you from prison, and I'm aware you've been untrue. It's been lonely here in prison, and I too have turned to strangers for comfort. I never knew what love really was. I never thought I could feel so free. I met my true love and the hoof gal. I didn't realize it till now. He's always been there to lend a helping hand. And he's a damn good looking man. He's not grouchy in the morning. Small. He carries me to bed and he gently strokes my head. soon I'll be released. But I won't be coming home. You know, I blame you for my sentence. Please, Julie, don't you write me anymore. I met my true love in the Hoos Gal. I didn't realize it till now. He's always been there to lend a helping hand. And he's a damn good-looking man. He's not grouchy in the morning. Downwind listens lovingly, and he's in love with me behind these prison walls. I never knew what love really was. I never thought I could feel so free.
And starting off this kick-ass set was a artist that comes from Austin, Texas. His name is Lucas Hudgens, and it was the song Three Chairs. And it's off his CD or album, The World Left Is Mine. Lucas is an awesome fucking singer. His shit's the real deal. I dig his whole album. It's awesome. Fucking awesome. I think you can get his shit on CD, baby. You folks need to go get it. He's got a tremendous album, I must say. It reminds you of old classic shit, you know, like Johnny Cash. Hey, he's a good songwriter, good singer. He's fucking awesome. That's all I could say about old Lucas. And the second song in this set was a group by the name of The Defibrillators. And it was a song called Your Hearty Laugh. And it was off their CD, Corn Money. Another great CD, a little something different. And ending this set was the Wapner County Country All-Stars with the song Sorry Grandma. And it was off their CD, or album, I should say, Always a Pleasure. Great fucking set right there, I'm telling you what. Well, let me see here. We're going to get in the interview with Pete Berwick after I do another song, but I must admit something. My wife has been holding that pussy hostage. I need to come up with some ransom money or something to get some of that. You know, beating off just ain't the same. I've tried everything. I've even sat on my hand until it falls asleep, and then I beat off with my hand that fell asleep and it feels like someone else has beaten me off. I've tried that. I've tried a fucking saran wrap with cream in it. You know, but it ain't the same as pussy. And gosh damn it, hun, I need some. So let's get in this next song. And we're going to do a song by a group from Savannah, Georgia that goes by the name of Tenderloin Trio. Great fucking band with a awesome, peculiar, different sound. I totally dig them. And it's a song called Lou. And then we'll get into the Pete Berwick interview. Bitches!
Let me tell you. Crazy.
Folks, with me on the phone, I have Pete Berwick. How are you doing, Pete?
Doing great, Donnie. Thanks for having me today. I really appreciate being here on White Trash Revival.
No problem. I'm glad to have a guy like yourself on my show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So let's tell all these folks how you got started and where you're from, what you're all about.
Well, ever since I was a kid, I always there was an acoustic guitar lying around the house. To beat on. I grew up in northern Illinois, and my grandmother passed on this acoustic guitar that was sitting around the house, so I beat on it, and I guess I made a half-assed attempt to write songs, but I knew right away that that's what I wanted to do, you know, listening to Bob Dylan records and whatnot, and that was probably my first influence, and so I started writing and making my half-assed attempts at pumping out songs, and then speed up a little bit, moved to Florida when I was a teenager, and that's when I really got into writing seriously, 16, 17, and by the time we moved back from Florida, well, my folks left me down there, they moved back to Illinois, and then I stayed there for another year or two, just kind of kicking around, and trying to put bands together, and nothing worked out, came back to Illinois, and put together my first band around 79, and, you know, went out doing cover songs and realized that, you know, that wasn't what I wanted to keep doing, doing weddings and stuff like that, and started getting, you know, I was a little punk rocker, you know, I was really into what was going on in New York, New York Dolls, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop. Of course, when the Ramones came out, that was just it for me, you know, because that's really where I saw music going anyway, because I was really into, like, you know, Lou Reed and the New York Dolls and really early punk like the MC5, you know, and the Ramones just kind of solidified that. And of course I also had a, you know, great love of Johnny Cash and the Outlaws and Willie and Waylon, all those guys, and I just seemed natural to me to take all those musics I loved. You know, to me, punk rock and the outlaw music, it was just all one and the same. To me, it really seemed very similar, just in its, if nothing else, in its attitude and its philosophy, you know, and that all made total sense to me at a very early age. And so I put together, like, you know, made some couple attempts to put together these cowpunk bands, and it was kind of tough because it was hard to find players with my vision and whatnot, even harder to find club owners who shared that vision. You know, you come in, they're like, what's this shit? You know, where's the cover songs? Where's the Bon Jovi and the REO Speedwagon, you know? And it's like, you know, so kind of gave up on that in 89, moved to Nashville, and then I spent 5 years in Nashville.
Now, when you moved to Nashville, that's when you started getting into country, right?
Yeah, well, I was writing country. But, you know, I wanted to move down there because I wanted to strengthen my songwriting. I really was serious about being the best songwriter I could. So I've been writing cowpunk and, you know, honky-tonk country and ballads. And just kind of, I really was trying to find a direction as, and of course, at this point, I really, you know, I couldn't say then, nor could I say now, that I'm a country artist. As a matter of fact, I pretty much disassociated myself, unfortunately, with saying I'm a country artist. Although, you know, people like you, your station, other stations, you know, that we're good friends with, like Outlaw Country and, you know, Saving Country website, and Saving Country Music and other good friends of ours. They're making every effort to restore the good name of country. But unfortunately, I'm at a point now where I do not say I'm a country artist, because then, you know, what, they're going to associate me with Taylor Swift, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a singer-songwriter, and some people call it cowpunk, which I'm comfortable with, too.
I call it underground country. That's what I tell everybody I listen to. My
exactly.
Radio show's all about.
Insurgents. So, but, you know, at this time, then, of course, you know, you know, there was a time when commercial country really was not as disgusting as it was now, you know, because, you know, you had some pretty decent artists around the time I moved to Nashville who were commercial. I mean, you know, Alan Jackson was doing some good stuff. You know, Clint Black had some stuff that wasn't terrible, you know, and, you know, the Judds, they were making some good music. You know, I know we're talking about commercial pop country, but my... You know, I take those artists I just named, and many back in that time when I went down there in a heartbeat over the swill that's being forced to us now, you know?
Yeah.
Because still, you know, people like, when I went to Nashville, a lot of the people that were making it like that, I mean, even Garth Brooks, I mean, you know, a lot of these people, they've been hacking away in bars, they've been paying dues, that they were willing to risk it all, you know, and they were still playing by the rules of being a true country artist, you know. And they weren't just, there was no internet then, so, you know, like these wannabes today, they weren't.
Right. And you got a guy by the name of Jamie Johnson that could be a decent outlaw country singer, but the only thing that's really fucking him up is he wrote Honky Tonk Badonkadonk, which is like the worst fucking song, the epitome of pop country. And, you know, that's...
Is that one of the Big and Rich song?
That's the Trace Atkins made it popular, but Jamie Johnson wrote it, and that's going to be the epitome of, you know, that's what's killing him.
That really was those kind of songs. She Thinks My Tractor Sexy, or Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy. It was these kind of songs which really were the beginning. Have really put the death quail in.
That's what killed country music.
Yeah, it's become so imbecile and just so ridiculous. And you know, sure, you know, a lot of the hardcore country, you know, Tammy Wynette, George Jones, you know, the drink and cheat and stuff, and, you know, and people like, oh, yeah, well, you know, there's sex and there's singing about cheating and whatnot, but, you know, but that was real life stuff, you know, drinking and cheating and fighting that kind of stuff. It always went on, it always will. But see, I know how Nashville thinks, and see, that stuff's become, you know, that stuff's become anathema, you know. It's like, okay, you can say it, but say it in, like, a cutesy way, you know. I heard some Rascal Flatts song while I was setting up at a bar over the summer, and I almost wanted to throw up. It was just something like, you know, shake it, shake it. You know, looking sexy, and it was like the closest I could ever hear country coming to like disco or like Casey and the Sunshine Band. You know,
them guys are pitiful. They got their fucking highlighted hair, their fucking tight jeans, wearing their $150 Western T-shirts. It's fucking ridiculous, and you know they're killing country.
Exactly.
I like my music to tell a story, and what they sing tells shit.
Exactly. But anyway, so when I went to Nashville, you know, Garth Brooks was exploding, and the Hat Acts were taken off, and it was difficult for someone like me. Steve Earle had done his good share of pissing off everybody in town, and you know, becoming addicted to crack, and that didn't help my cause. You know, I signed with an independent label on Music Row called Bitter Creek Records, and he could only do so much. Very, very low rent record label, you know, but you know, he believed in my music. I signed a management deal with him. We went in and did an album at Waylon Jennings' old studio, and you know, and then he's shopping it around, and you know, he went to MCA, and you know, MCA said, no, we don't want another Steve Earle, you know, and that's the kind of shit we were hearing, you know. It's like, because, you know, they try to turn Steve Earle into a Randy Travis, you know, and he wouldn't have anything of it, and good for him. But, you know, in the process, he you know, he pissed off. He just, you know, he kind of did what the Sex Pistols did to the Ramones, I think. You know, he just kind of like gave. Because alternative country, you know, Steve Earle had like a number one record with Guitar Town, and it really opened the doors for a lot of alternative country writers like myself. And but then, you know, once he crashes and burns and goes to jail for crack, and I don't know, you know, it just, he didn't carry himself well, and I it didn't help the cause of people like me at that time, because there, when I went down there, there seemed to be a real vibe going on. Hey, this alternative country thing to take off. But of course, Nashville's always fought against that anyway. They did it with Johnny Cash. They did it, you know, with Willie and Waylon. And, you know, if Nashville had their way, Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and all the other outlaws would have never happened. They fought that movement tooth and nail. But when the outlaws went down to Texas and built a huge scene down there, the numbers couldn't be denied, and Nashville had to open their arms and say, okay, you know, we'll bring into the family, and but it was only reluctantly. So we recorded an album. It ended up sitting on a shelf because my record label just went bankrupt, and I left town in '96, came back here, and I took it off the shelf in 2007 because I recorded an album in 2002 called Only Bleeding, and I thought, I want to record another one, and I thought, wait a second, I got this thing sitting here, which I just kind of forgotten about because there's so much ill will wrapped around the recording and the falling out I had with my record label.
So when you was down in Nashville, it wasn't very good time for you?
It wasn't a good time to be there?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I can't. Who's to say what's a good time to make any move? But I don't think it's ever. I think it's ever a good time to be in Nashville unless you're pop.
Yeah.
You know. But no. You know what? I love the place, and I would go back there. I'm going to be making more frequent trips down there in the future. I hadn't been there in. God, I hadn't gone back there in like 10 years after I moved back to Illinois, but then I booked a couple tours to go through there, and I played a couple shows, which went real well, and I'm going to be doing more of that. You know, because you know what? It really is a good place, and I could never discourage any songwriter or artist to go there, because you can't look at the surface. You can't just look at Nashville as like today, Taylor Swift and Kenny Chesney and the
Rascal Flatts, Keith Urban.
You can't go there thinking, okay, I'm going to compete with that, or I'm going to be one of them, unless you're that kind of artist, and more power to you. But underneath that, there is always a great scene happening. Singer-songwriters, underground bands, you know. There's not a lot of places to play live, and you're not going to make much money, but like the writers' nights are great. I made so many friends at the writers' nights, and I'll tell you, you know, you can have a song, break out. I got lucky at a writers' night. I went to the Bluebird, you know, as I'd done many times before, stood in line, you know, put my name in the hat, okay, Pete, you're going up 15th, you know, and you get up there and you do your two songs, you know, and it was just, I was going to get up there, do my two songs, throw back a couple beers, hang out, and end up going home. And so I'm up there singing my two songs, and one of them was Ain't No Train Out of Nashville, which I wrote in a publisher's office. Well, I overheard a conversation. This guy looked homeless. He's just coming to Nashville. I heard him talking. While I was waiting to talk to the publisher, I heard him complaining about there ain't no train to Nashville. He had to, like, take a bus or some shit, and I thought, hey, there's a title there. I just turned it around and wrote Ain't No Train Out of Nashville, and it's a song about a songwriter, you know, somewhat autobiographical, comes to town, he's pumping gas, can't get a break, on and on. It's a funny song. And I was singing Bluebird, and Dermot Mulroney was in the audience, who was co-starring with River Phoenix in the movie being filmed at the time in Nashville called The Thing Called Love. I don't know if you heard of that movie. I don't know. It didn't do too well at the theaters.
And I think I've seen it.
River Phoenix died of an overdose shortly after that. But anyway, so Dermot liked the song. Long story short, he brought it to the, he asked me to give a tape of it, brought it to the producer, Peter Bogdanovich, and it ended up in the movie. So, you know, that shit, it can happen. You know, I was just reading recently an interview with Garth Brooks, and he, you know, before anybody knew who he was, okay, he was signed, and, you know, he was being groomed and going through the artist development and all that, but, you know, nobody knew who the hell he was, and he would go around and to all the writers' nights, and he'd just sit there and looking for songs, you know, and he found some songs that way, and I tend to believe that that still goes on. I know, you know, you don't hear about the songwriters. You know, all you read about and hear about are the stars with the hits. But the people supplying these songs, you don't, they're not household names, but it's amazing the people out there who you'll never hear about, the songwriters who you will never read about or hear about, have done amazing things.
Right, because most people in public think that, you know, they think Taylor Swift writes all of her songs and Miley Cyrus and all that bullshit. But
they want you to think that. They want you
right,
to
right.
think that shit. And they're going to tell you that so that they're more respected as an artist. But you know what, man? Very few people. I really doubt that. How old is she? 18, 19? I mean, that they're going to let some kid, you know, because, you know, the greatest songwriters in the world are in Nashville. And many of them are hacks. Many of them are just hacks, and that's why this stuff sounds like such pap, because they sit in cubicles. They go into office buildings, and they sit in cubicles and write 9-to-5. You know, well, you know, I like to say you can't write like that. I can't, but, you know, you can, I guess, because, you know, they're using graphs and numbers, and they got bean counters telling them, okay, this is what was a hit yesterday, and they're writing accordingly to that blueprint, you know? So, but, you know, there's people writing good stuff, true stuff, and you know, I know songwriters go to these writers' nights. Unfortunately, I know some of them like to prey on songs, too. They like to steal ideas and whatnot, and you hope that doesn't happen to you, but, no, I think Nashville is great for that, and sometimes I miss it. You know, being up here in Northern Illinois, you know, I'm playing, you know, biker bars and restaurants and roadhouse dives and any place I can, and you know, it's all you can do to get an audience to even give a shit that you're there half the time, because, you know, these bars, they got 20 televisions, they got pool tables, you know, they got, you know, there's so many distractions. But when you perform in Nashville, 9 out of 10 times the people you're performing to are actually there to listen to music. The song is still appreciated and revered in Nashville.
All right, let's change it a little bit here, and let's go with some of your influences, you know, musical-wise. Who would you consider some of your biggest influences and, you know, made you get into music and write the songs you do?
Well, definitely Bob Dylan. I say Bob Dylan was probably one of my earliest influences. You know, just the genius of the man's wordplay, and to me, he was like punk rock in the sense that you didn't have to be great. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You didn't have to be Beethoven. You could just, you know, strum a guitar, and, you know, because like with Dylan, the guitar was just a backdrop for his brilliant lyrical writing and his wordplay.
Right, because,
you know,
he wasn't the greatest fucking singer there was, but he told an excellent story, and that's what the music's all about, tell a story.
Good point. Exactly. You know, in the same sense, you didn't have to be and you know, the rock and roll that's how it should be, and that's how a great country is. But unfortunately,
right. And just like Hank Williams, like I've been reading his biography, and you know, back then, no one even fucking liked him, and they thought he was a joke, and they thought he couldn't sing. But the dude was a brilliant fucking songwriter.
Exactly, and he was, and you know, and when he sang, you know, you could hear the pain. What amazes me, and you know, Hank Williams too. Well, I'm glad you, because I might have forgotten to say, but Hank Williams Sr. certainly was an influence too. He was my, you know, long before Johnny Cash, he was just it, you know. And I hardly ever knew of any other country names or anything, you know. But Hank Williams was always there. He to me represented country music, and
he's one of the only guys that could make you actually feel what he was
right.
singing about.
And isn't it sad though that today Hank Williams Sr. would not make it? You know, I mean, most people would not make it.
Yeah, it's a shame.
You know, they sing funny, or they don't have the image or whatever. I mean, I thought he had the image. I mean, Hank Williams Sr. was country. He lived, he had the hard life. He had the physical ailments, you know. And I think Hank Williams got a bum rap because, you know, for the drinking and the pills, because, you know, what a lot of people don't know is that Hank Williams had spina bifida.
Right, he did.
You try playing some place and then driving across the country all night, you know, with that, with spina bifida, and damn it to hell, I know I would have taken pills too.
Right, he was constantly in pain.
Yeah, I would have taken anything, and that's how a lot of those country cash and all the rest of them, that's how they got addicted to speed. It really was out of necessity, because, you know, they'd play a place, and then they'd drive, you know, three states over to the next one. They'd have to drive all night, and they didn't have the luxury of sleeping, or the money wasn't there for a room. So and you don't want to crash at the wheel, so you take the pills.
Right.
And you know what? I would have done the same damn thing. And but anyway, so get off subject again. But yeah, Dylan, there's definitely Hank, Johnny Cash, and certainly the Ramones, although I was really doing punk before I heard the Ramones the first time. I was kind of experimenting with, because like I said, before the Ramones, Iggy Pop and Lou Reed I was into, and really like the Ramones, and I credit the Ramones. I'm a big Ramones historian and advocate, and I could just fill a whole radio show talking about their story and how they got pissed on and the unrightfulness of their legacy. And
right.
But when I first heard them, it brought it all together for me. And I knew that this was where rock and roll was going. And I was excited because, to me, Johnny Cash and the Ramones were really like, you know, to me, and you might not hear the Ramones. You'll probably hear it maybe. You might hear some of it in my music. It depends on your experiences with the music, but to me, it's philosophy too. I think if you're going to make it in music, you need a really good work ethic. It's not enough for the young people out there listening. It's not enough to sit there and upload your songs to MySpace and think that you're going to be huge and that anybody gives a shit. You're really a non-entity if you're not out there in the trenches working. And if you can't tour, you got to be out there playing every freaking night you can in front of an audience, even if it's for free, even if it's on a street corner, because otherwise you don't exist.
Right.
And the Ramones, you know, they were out there 25-something years touring in a van, getting pissed on. And like I said, the Sex Pistols fucked it up for them, because after the Sex Pistols, you know, they were assholes. They'd go into radio interviews, vomiting on the console, insulting the interviewer, you know, and blacklisted punk rock, you know, and the Ramones could get a break, but they kept going anyway. They kept going and going and going until they freaking literally died. You know, three of them are all dead now, and I embrace that spirit of never quitting. To me, that's rock and roll, man. That's just, you do it till you drop, you know, whether you become famous, whether anybody even cares, you know what I mean?
Right, and that's what it's all about.
Exactly.
You know, like Wayne Hancock traveling United States by van, you know, on a nightly basis, going to these little fucking rinky-dink dives.
That's right.
And just doing it to be doing it. And, you know, he's probably not making a shitload of money.
And it ain't about money.
Exactly.
If it was to stay home and be plumbers, or, you know, I can make much more money staying at home, but, you know, And I was listening to, as I told you earlier before we went on the air, I was listening to your interview that you did with James Honeycutt. And he totally nailed it. Everything he said was exactly how I feel. You know, you do it because, you know, you do it for the, I can't remember his exact words, but it was basically you do it for the love of it, you know. And
right. Because he said he had a great job with super benefits.
Right.
But, you know, he said, you know, he had a dream and it was either now or never.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to wake up in some nursing home going, man, shoulda, woulda, coulda. The time is now. And I'll tell you, when I'm off on my, when I'm off touring and I don't usually go out, you know, for a month or two. I try to book like anywhere from 4 to 10 day tours. Come around, come home, you know, hang around a month, play local, you know, spend time with the wife and kid, and then I'll go out again. And I think that's a healthy tour. Not that I won't, but it for one thing, I don't know if anybody who's tried booking a 2-month tour, but so times when I'm out there, you know, and I'm sleeping in my car or driving through the night, you know, I'll sleep in my car just to save the money for the hotel room. And, you know, that's some of the funnest times I've ever had, man. It's just great, you know, because you're really, that's the end result of why you get into music.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I think anybody that gets into music to be rich and famous with this American Idol mentality is in for a big letdown. And if that's your goal, then good luck, because you're not going to be, you know, if you can't be satisfied going out there doing it just for the sake of doing it, you know. I'm reading this great biography right now on Bob Dylan. It's written by Bob Spitz, who I believe also biographied a Beatles book. And, you know, Dylan, when he was all the rage in Greenwich Village, when he was like the up-and-coming thing, and, you know, and there was that great scene in Greenwich Village where, you know, tourists, people were coming on vacation just to go to the folk clubs, you know, and see live music. God, that must have been a great scene, you know. And now people go to clubs to watch the ball game while you're singing in the corner and being ignored. But, you know, even Dylan, when he was, going gangbusters in the Greenwich Village days, he wasn't making but maybe 50, 80 bucks a week, you know, sleeping on people's couches. But, you know, the guy was doing what he knew he had to do.
Yeah. And now look at him. He's probably real comfortable now.
Yeah, slightly. He has been for a while.
Well, how about this, Pete? How about we take a break and listen to one of your songs off your newest album? You'd like to tell everybody what it's called?
Well, why don't we spin Vacancy in My Heart? That's one that I actually wrote in Nashville. Sitting in my apartment, just kind of pounded it out, and that would have been 93 or so, and I finally recorded it on my album released, in my recent album, Just Another Day in Hell, which I just released in 2009. So yeah, that would be a good one to kick off, I guess. Get the motor running.
All right, well, let's do it right now then.
All right, buddy.
One, two, three, four, one!
right, and we are back. So tell me, Pete, how you came up with that song?
You know, I really don't remember, Donnie. It's just the way I usually write. I'll grab my acoustic. I write everything on my acoustic and my trusty Guild here. And just started, that was one where I most likely just started pounding away, you know. And I'm sure at the time I was feeling a certain amount of aggression. I'm sure I was feeling aggression and antipathy against powers that be down on Music Row, so I kind of just that song just kind of came out in a torrent of anger, you know. But I can't really, I can be more specific about where other songs came from. You want to talk about other songs in the album, I can be more specific about those because I wrote them more recently. But
right,
that's you know, that was just kind of like a fun balls to the wall blaster, you know, and there's really no great story behind that one.
So you've been in this business for quite a long time, and who are some of the people you shared the stage with? You know, some of the more known people that a lot of us would know.
Well, Charlie Daniels, I did a show with him, opened up for him back in Newport Richey around 92, and Doug Kershaw, the legendary wild man fiddler from Louisiana. Joe Son, he's not really a household name, but he's a legend in my eye. Jan Howard, not really a household name, but she was a Grand Ole Opry performer back in the day, and a few others I can't remember. I really haven't. I wish I could say that I've got this really big long list of major artists that I've shared the stage with, but my story's really been one of grinding it out on my own. You know, I never really, I guess, made a concerted effort to reach out, and, you know, I'm doing more of that now, actually. I communicated with Tommy Cash about a month ago. I don't know, a lot of people don't know, but Johnny Cash has a brother, Tommy Cash, who I met. I met in Florida when I was doing that concert with Charlie Daniels, and Tommy was also on the bill. And I wrote to him, you know, and he acted like he remembered me. Maybe it was just being nice. We were backstage together talking, and I just asked him if I could, you know, open up with him on his tours and whatnot. And of course, that's usually the answer you get. Was what I get. It's usually out of their hands, you know. You usually have to. It's really hard for artists to help other artists a lot of times. Even. You know, even if a major artist wants to help you, you got to go through the powers that be, you know, and it could be a real bureaucracy. And, you know, I find it's just easier to just book my own jobs and go out there and do it on my own, you know. Of course, the payoff of opening up for somebody much more established with you is the built-in audience, you know. And in that respect, you're more than glad to do it for free because, you know what, I'd rather play in front of an audience of hundreds of people for free than make like my $150 playing to, you know, 10 drunks in some roadhouse dive that aren't going to even remember you in the morning, you know? Which is...
So, you ever been starstruck meeting any of these bigwigs down in Nashville and all that good stuff?
No, not really. You know, because, like, one thing you learn real quick in Nashville, and I kind of learned it, was you stay cool because you don't want to. And I found myself on more than one occasion, like standing right next to, oh my gosh, this is you know, Mark Collier. Here comes Alan Jackson walking down the hallway. Oh, and that happened, I was always bumping into Marty Stewart all the time. It seemed every time I turned around, there he was, you know. And great guy, you know. I was never too shy to. And when I would see one of these country stars, you know, sometimes I go out of my way to shake hands with him, but sometimes I just, something told me to just let him walk by, because it's a small town, you know, and you if you want to be a player, if you want to, like, see, I think it helps more to look at these people, even though they're miles above you. You got to always think of them somehow as peers, I guess, because they are. They're doing the same thing you are, except they happen to become famous or make it quicker. But you can't, you know, you don't want to show, because, you know, that's what the tourists do. You know, the tourists come there and with, you know, wanting autographs and whatnot, and you're not a tourist. You have to remind yourself that, you know, you can be as good as them, or you are as good as them. It's just the only reason you're not where they are is because they got the luck break, or they worked harder, they started sooner. So that's kind of the attitude that I had. And I was in some country music videos. I was, you know, I worked as an extra when I was down there because I was slaving at the car wash, you know, and I took the shittiest job I could in Nashville because I wanted the freedom to blow off work or just take off. It was the kind of job where you could come and go at your, make your own hours, and I didn't want some kind of a job where, you know, I had to beg the boss, hey, you know, let me off at 3, you know, I got a meeting with a publisher, or I got an audition for a music video. And I was in several country music videos, you know, I was making, like, you know, $75 a day, you know, sit around and wait. And so, you know, I met Patti Loveless, I met Joe Diffie, and I was in a Travis Tritt video, although I never saw him on the set. I was in a video with Kentucky Headhunters, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, it's funny, you know, because when you're working with these guys, and they're hanging right out there, they look like any other old scruffy dude. And I think, you know, once you meet Charlie Daniels, I had breakfast with him and some other musicians, and I didn't even recognize him. You know, I opened up for Charlie Daniels, and then we were all staying at the same hotel. The next morning, I went down to the hospitality suite. You know, Charlie had this private room for all the bands and the musicians, and I walk in there, and there's this bald guy with you know, grandpa glasses reading the paper, and I thinking, who's this old guy in the corner? You know, because I'd never seen Charlie Daniels without his cowboy hat, the big old cowboy hat that he wears down, you know, almost to his nose. And I started talking to the guy. He's reading the paper, and I saw that Charlie Daniels on the cover of the Newport Richie Times, because they were talking about the Charlie Daniels concert yesterday. It was a benefit for physically challenged kids. And I started talking to the guy, like, oh, I see you're reading I see Charlie's in the paper. And then the guy looks up at me and goes, oh, and he mumbles something. I go, oh, Mr. Daniels, that's you. You know, I didn't even know it was him. It's just some old bald guy sitting in the corner, you know?
Yeah.
And next thing, we're just, you know, we're just talking, we're just bullshitting, and it's great, you know, and I miss that. Really miss that in Nashville. I miss running into people like that. And like I said earlier, Donnie, you meet some of the phenomenal songwriters that have just, like, had, you know, dozens of hits. They've had the songs they've written, but you don't hear about them. And some of these songwriters are just out there playing the same clubs, and they're just kind of hacking away like everybody else, you know. And that's the thing. That's the brutality of the music business in Nashville. I mean, it's full of people who've had hits, and then you can go years without getting another cut. You know, it's like you're only as good as what you've done lately, you know.
So, what would you say is your most memorable time out there on the road or on the stage or what have you?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll tell you, the weekend I spent with doing the Charlie Daniels show, that was an entire weekend in Nashville, and then there were, like, all these parties tied into it because it was a benefit. And that definitely was an extraordinary weekend. Because that was milk for all it was worth, you know. I mean, it was just one party after another. They had, like, limousines parked out in the parking lot at our disposal, you know. And so, you know, like, if I wanted to go into town to get a pack of strings or something, the limo would take me. That was mind-blowing, you know. And just the total star treatment. That whole thing, so that was a real riot. I could definitely deal with that every weekend, you know, instead of the reality of what I'm doing, you know. Playing shithole dives for peanuts, but
yeah, you could get used to living large, huh?
Yeah, but you know, know, I wish I had more. I wish I had more wild from the road, from the gutter stories. But most stuff goes without a hitch. You know, it's just it's a job. You know, it's what you do, and you know, you're doing it so long, you just kind of know how to get in and out without it being too eventful. I haven't had. I don't think I've ever been. Well, yeah, I've been ripped off a couple times, but you know, just like James Honeycutt, you know, when he was telling his story of being ripped off in Reno, I think it was.
Yeah.
Guy only wanted to pay half because you know he had a sob story. Well, that's happened to me too, and he's right. You know, it's like you have two choices. You can either like you know take a bar stool over the guy's head. I mean, that was how they did it in the old days. You know. Packing a pistol, and you just, you know, you'd make them pay you a gunpoint, but, you know.
I think we should start exposing these motherfuckers that, you know, rip you guys off.
Yeah, I can think of one or two times where I played where, like, there was nobody there, you know, it was just dead, you know, bartender and his dog kind of thing, and sure, yeah, the guy is going to totally lose his ass, you know,
mm-hmm.
even though he's only owing me $100, $150, You know, what do you make at the bar that night? Five, you know?
Yeah, probably made a shitload at the bar.
But, you know, that's the risk. You know, the club owner has to carry some of that risk. And I'm still going through that here in Illinois, and I'm sure it's no different everywhere else. I know it's not because although when I'm on tour, you know, it's understood. When I book my tours, you know, the places I play know damn well I'm not going to bring people in because I'm from out of town, you know, unless it's promoted in a way where, you know, I have fans, you know, in other states and whatnot, you know, it's like pulling teeth it's hard to get bodies in, especially with this economy, but you know, when I play here, you know, I've got my circuit that I do where they're glad to pay me, they're glad to have me, and the draw is not the option because, you know, it's an attractive enough place to where people go anyway, you know, a bar has its following too, you know. But, mm-hmm. like, there's still these places where, you know, they blame you if it's a Saturday night and if the place ain't packed, it's your fault. It's the musician's fault.
Right.
And that's bullshit, you know, because it's like, you know, if it's not in your budget, if it's not in your budget to pay a little cash to have entertainment, then don't do it. Don't take that chance if you can't deal with the fact that it's going to be a slow night, you know.
Exactly.
Time and time again, I've seen this, especially where I live in northern Illinois. You know, I just nothing but small towns, you know, and you go and play these places. It happened recently. You know, I played this, like, you know, the only bar in town kind of joint, and like the high school football playoffs were going on that night, and the whole freaking town was over at the games, you know. And that's all it can take to make for a slow night at some bar, you know.
Right.
But yet they're always going to find a way to blame you, you know.
Well, Pete, how about we get into another song off your album, and then we'll come back and finish the interview up.
Okay, how about, talking of the road and everything, this is one I was on tour about a year and a half ago. I was leaving a show in Indiana. I was on my way to Nashville, and I had a little altercation with Kentucky State Trooper, and I'll let the song tell the story. It's all true. It's on the new album, Just Another Day in Hell. It's called Busted in Kentucky.
I love that song.
I just answered your question, Donnie. You're asking me about any wild experiences on the road. I'd already, I wasn't thinking about this, but here you go. This is probably one of the most recent. If you want to call it a wild experience, I'd call it a day from hell. But
yeah, that's a great fucking song. I do love it, and I fucking hate state troopers. They're total pricks. You know, my wife just got nailed by a state trooper for expired tags and all that bullshit.
Right,
them dudes are dicks. They don't want to give the working man a break. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this guy had a hard on for my Illinois plates. He pulled me over for he made up some cockamamie reason for pulling me over, like I failed to merge, or
yeah.
I failed to yield to merging traffic coming out of the highway.
And he was probably like all these other state troopers.
I was the only car on the road, man. I'm like 65 miles an hour driving like a grandma. Pulled me over, and Well, you know what? I'll let the song tell the story. If anybody who cares to listen, it's all true. And when I was released, I missed my show in Nashville. And when I was released, I wrote this song on the steering wheel of my car, and the words just came out. And see, to me though, I think a good lesson in life is learning how to make lemonade out of lemons. And it was a shitty thing that happened. I missed a show. I got, you know, I'm still serving. I got 6 months left on a 2-year probation, which is almost like a prison sentence because you never know when they're going to call you to go take that piss test.
Exactly.
And so I'm looking. That's why I haven't really booked any tours, really, like in the last. It's almost been a couple years since I've done little things like, you know, I try to get back home. I've done dates where I've, like, you know, I don't want to stay in a hotel. I want to get back home because if those fuckers call me and I don't go take that piss test by 5, I could actually go down there and do time. That's how fucking brutal they are.
Yeah.
But what I did was I got a good song out of the ordeal. It helped inspire the album cover because I really was blank as far as an album cover. So if you look at the cover of Just Another Day in Hell, it's a picture of me in cuffs. And going back to what I was saying about these hack songwriters in Nashville that go and write in cubicles, you know, you can't write in a fucking cubicle, and that's why this stuff sounds like pop piss, you know. It's like, you know, to me, the great country, it was always great, it will always be great because it was written by men and women who are out there experiencing times, you know. Hard times, good times. At any rate, they'd experience the richness of life, the brutalities, the loves, the losses, the hurts, the pains, and they write about it, you know. And many of them weren't extremely educated people, but they knew how to express their experiences in song. And that's I'm trying to carry that tradition the best I can, you know. And that's not the only song I wrote on the steering wheel of my car. And most of the songs, especially on my new album, many of the songs I write, just about every song on my new album, all 18 of them were written either in motel rooms or in sitting in my car in some desolate parking lot killing time before a show or in this case, being released from a detention center.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get in this song, and, you know, it's a great song, and then we'll come back and finish it up.
All right, buddy.
All right.
State trooper pulled me over, southbound 65. Had a gig in Nashville, I was running a bit behind. His canine friend sniffed out my car every single inch. Smelling for some cocaine, but I never touched that shit. About a quarter gram of Mexican, barely enough to get me high. Still slapped the cuffs on and drug me in as daylight turned to night. Well, if I'd been fine in Louisville, those boys would have made my day. Probably ripped me up a citation and then sent me on my way. But further down in Elizabethtown, them cops don't mess around. It's all the same to their inbred brains, pin joint or a pound. They threw me in the drunk tank, though I hadn't touched a drop. I sat there for 9 hours just cursing out that cop. My bail was set at $500 more than I even make. Still called the wife and she wired it to the jail on the next day. Well, on the phone my kid was crying, she thought that I'd been dead. After 2 days in that hellhole, I almost wish I had. I've been riding on that it so long, reckless, wild and lucky. But on the road in Nashville I got busted in Kentucky. Transferred to a cell with a couple other guys. Some farm boy in for dealing meth and a black dude doing life. Picked up the Gideon's Bible, but my eyes too tired to read. They were written annihilated, but it wasn't from the weed. I've been driving several hours from a gig in Valparaiso. How I ended up here, I'm barely posted. I'd miss my Nashville show. Still plenty of time to make the next one, just a little off the road. Three people paid the cover charge. I made about $7. Busted in Kentucky and then clean out of luck. I've been riding down that is so long, reckless, wild, and lucky. But on the road in Nashville, I got busted in Kentucky. I've been riding down that is so long, reckless, wild, and lucky. But on the road in Nashville, I got busted. Kentucky rain keeps falling down.
And we are back, and I am sorry for the technological problems there, Pete.
No problem, Donnie. Shit happens.
Yeah, it always happens to me, though.
I have plenty of technological problems.
Yeah. So I've been on your MySpace page, and I noticed in your blog section that you have been on Wife Swap.
Yes, busted once again.
Yes. So, was you tricked? Did you think that you was going on some type of swinger thing, or did you know what it was all about?
Yeah, I was very disappointed when I found out that I actually had to take my wife back. I thought I'd finally gotten rid of her. Like Henny Youngman, take my wife, please.
Yeah.
Almost sued him for that. It's like, wait, you're not supposed to bring her back? I'd heard of the show, and I never had any aspirations to be on a reality show, but they actually contacted me. ABC apparently has scouts out there aggressively scouting for, you know, people to be on the show, you know. And I guess the other reality shows do the same kind of thing. And, you know, at first I thought it was a scam. Got an email that they said they were looking for a family and entertainment and blah-de-da, and I thought it was a con. I thought, well, it doesn't hurt to just reply, test the water, see if this is for real. Went on and on, back and forth, and turned out it was. And next thing we knew, we were on reality television. And I almost wasn't going to do it, but the deciding factor was I thought it'd be a good way to showcase my music. You know, get my music out in front of a national audience, which doesn't, you know, you don't get that opportunity every day.
Right, so you got to jump on it when it arises.
Exactly. There's nothing wrong with a little mass exposure if you can get it, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, what artist would turn that down, you know?
Really. So how's your wife with your music career? Is she supportive or what? She's okay with you going on tour and stuff like that, being out there?
Oh, yeah, she's always been supportive. You know, I met her in a musical situation. We met in a songwriting class here in Illinois, and, you know, at the time she was writing lyrics and poetry. She's long since stopped doing it, kind of lost an interest, but at the time we met that way, and that's how we dated, you know. Instead of the dinner and the movie thing, we'd get together and write songs together. It was pretty cool. And as a matter of fact, on my next album, I'm actually going to record a song that a boy's gone through so many changes and metamorphoses, but it was actually a lyrical idea that she had that I kind of ran with and remained the inspiration for a song I'm going to record, like, what, 25 years later, you know?
Yeah.
We were co-writing when we first met, so it's just kind of an interesting... it's just an interesting way of how songs can stay alive, and you don't record them until the time's right. But yeah, so we met that way in music, and you know, she went to Nashville with me. That was a tough thing because she quit a pretty decent job to go down there, and yeah, nobody's been more supportive than her, you know, and that helps because you know, you it's not going to work, you know, if you've got a spouse that's jealous of what you're doing. You know, they give you that you love your guitar or you love your music line more than me, you know, that old line, like, you know, this more than me. And, you know, I've seen too many guys, you know, pussy whipped and unable to do what they really wanted to do. You gotta, you know, they're faced with having to make that choice, and that's unfortunate if you have to make that choice, you know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you got a great lady in your corner, and that's what it's all about right there.
You really does help. You know, you got to have some, you know, nobody wants a hostile home life. You know, your home's a place you should be able to come and have some peace. There's enough hostility. It's a hostile world all out there, you know, and,
yeah.
and you don't need that. You don't need that at home. You know, I mean, nothing's ever perfect at home, but you got to have a place to where you can come home and at least know that, you know,
yeah.
some kind of balance, you know, and that does help.
Yeah.
And it's always been easy, believe me. I mean, I don't have the tranquil, perfect relationship by a long shot. My
yeah.
wife and I are opposite in many ways, and we have our share of headbutting, but, you know, we've been together a long time, and I'm faithful to her, and she's faithful to me, and, you know, I don't mess around. I unlike a lot of people, I didn't get into music for the, you know, the sex and drugs. I got into it for just the drugs. No, I'm just kidding.
So,
music, you know, I mean, I don't go on the road to you know, I stay faithful. I'm true to my wife and kid, and, you know, I stay faithful to my family and to my music. I think that pays dividends in itself, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's pretty stand up of you. Cause,
well, you got to stand for something. I mean, yeah. I've got a long list of faults and frailties, you know. I have my issues, you know, but it's good to have, you know, at least one moral, ethical thing you can hang your hat on, you know.
Yeah.
And then if everything else goes to hell,
yeah,
something to hold on to, you know.
So what's what we got in store from you for 2010?
Well, just keep what I've been doing, you know, hacking away at the clubs in my state and. You know, basically for the last 2 years, I've been the Midwest, mostly playing Illinois, up into Wisconsin, Indiana. It's been mainly those three states, you know, clubs I can play in and sleep in my own bed that night. But kind of been staying close to home last year and a half, 2 years, pounding away the Midwest. But I'm putting together a tour in September, a two-week tour that's going to take me south through Kentucky. I'm going to try to stay away from that detention center this time. Nashville, Florida, and then Georgia, and then some other dates I still have yet to fit in. And then I want to get back up into, probably go back up north into Minnesota again. Got some clubs up there that are welcoming me back, and whatever else I can put together, I'm going to try to get on the road more, and just keep hacking away. I've also got the fourth album. I got those songs pretty much ready to go, and I'm just waiting for the right time to. I don't know if that's going to be in 2010 or 11. I don't know. I even surprised myself. You know, I don't have it all planned out, you know?
Yeah.
That's a fun part of this business. The shit can really change, you know? I mean, you'll be looking at, like, your next month going, oh, man, I only got a couple dates out there. And then when that month's over, by the time that month's over, you might have done 9 or 10 shows, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of last-minute stuff happens.
Right.
I'm doing, next month's fun. I got this live TV taping I'm doing. I was on this show before. It's a cable show called Psycho Babble, and they're going to be filming live in Zany's Comedy Club at Pheasant Run Inn here in Illinois, and I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, just doing as much as I can, one day at a time. And just
so,
having fun doing it, you know?
What's your... Tell us about your record label.
It's my label's my own label. It's Shotgun Records, and I do my own everything, you know. And, I got a independent distributor in Oregon that's doing a pretty good job getting me distributed. And,
yeah.
And, online and in stores and.
So if
you know,
some.
It's all pretty small time, you know, by industry standards. But you know, I'm getting done as much as I can, doing the best
right.
I can with it all, you know.
So, if someone wanted to pick up some of your albums, where would they go to get them?
My website, PeteBerwick.net. You can go to my MySpace and direct links there where you can purchase them. I prefer, you know, my own website because then I get all the proceeds.
Right.
And it goes back to my favorite charity, which will be my next album.
And I know I picked up your newest album on iTunes.
iTunes, yeah. It's not hard to find. It's all over the Internet. Pretty hard to find in stores. I mean, you can get it at Borders and Barnes and Noble.
Those record stores even exist anymore?
They have, yeah, they're... it's sad, like even the Borders and Barnes and Noble. I was in Borders the other day, and my God, it's like the ever-shrinking record section, you know?
Yeah.
Every time I go in there, excuse me, seems like it's smaller and smaller, you know?
But, yeah.
They're still out there. There's one in my town, and they sell vinyl. They got 8-tracks, for God's sakes, you know?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But, yeah, it's, they're going by the wayside. I mean, I don't know. Does anybody even buy CDs anymore? I guess people still are, you know?
Yeah, most of the time, though, MP3s is where it's at, I guess.
See, the thing is, you're always going to have a physical product to sell at your shows.
Right, right.
I guess there's even new technology, though, that's taking care of that. I know there's, like, these credit card swiper deals that I've heard of bands. I don't think you'll ever see me using one. Maybe you will. I'd probably not, though. I'm old school, you know?
Yeah.
You know, these gizmos where the band can just take your credit card, swipe it, you know, these portable credit card swipers, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you sell. I myself, and I know other bands sell the bulk of their CDs at shows. You know, the thing is, you hear all about the demise of the CD, and it is. The CD sales are down like almost half. You know, and it's not just the independent artists; it's the major league artists too. You know, but the majority of people still are buying CDs as opposed to downloading, you know. So, you know, and still, believe it or not, there are still a hell of a lot of people without computers or internet access in America. It's hard to believe, you know. But there will always be people who
are against technology,
don't have computers or who aren't online, you know.
Right.
And I know some of these people, you know.
Yeah, I know a couple myself.
Right. So, you know. I still believe in the album concept. You know, I understand that you know, maybe somebody doesn't want the whole album. Hey, I like this song. And I make money from single song sales, and that's fine. Because it is about the song. But I still love, I love the artistic effort and practice of putting together an album that tells a story. You know?
Right. And that's what it's all about.
Just like in the old days. I mean, imagine, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. You know, gosh, from beginning to end, you would put that thing on and just go on this journey, you know?
Yeah.
So it always helped if you were doing it.
And every song was a different chapter.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine, oh, you know, I'm just going to download track 8 and 9 of Dark Side. I don't care about the rest of it. It's ludicrous to think of that, you know? You were buying a... You don't download page 15 of War and Peace, you know.
Right.
You don't say, well, you know what? I don't want the whole painting of the Last Supper. You know, cut out a couple of those disciples, and it's perfect for me. I don't like the way you painted those two disciples sitting next to Christ. You know.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess I just sound like an old fart, but I look at and the same with the movie. You know, I don't put on Scarface in there. I don't take my video cassette of Scarface and ask some guy, hey, can you, like, splice out, you know, this scene and that scene? I mean, you know, so a movie, a painting, a book, an album. I look at all those as, and that's why it's called album. It's an album of music. It's an album, you know, of work. I hate the term CD. It's so cold. You know, I mean, I have a couple CDs. I'm getting, like, 3.5% from them, you know? I hate that. You know, so-and-so artist has a new CD. That just sounds so sterile and cold, you know?
Yeah.
It's an album. It embodies an album of work, and it's frustrating to me because that's how I approach my albums. I almost called it record, which really would be showing my age. But I approached them, and I as one continuous journey, you know, and that's what I believe I accomplished with Just Another Day in Hell. I know I did with Ain't No Train Out of Nashville, right. And some of the critics perceived that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just become where it's like, you know, it is becoming more about the song. I guess in some ways it's kind of a return to the 45, you know, where you know, a 45 would come out with the hit or, you know, the song that the band or record label would choose to put out on a 45, you know.
Yeah.
Which basically you're getting this piece of plastic with the best song from the album that's side B would be whatever they throw on sometimes the D. You know.
All right. Well, what song would you like to end the interview off of your album?
Well, how about the title track?
Notice I said album.
Yes, thank you. that didn't even affect me. It sounded totally natural.
Yeah.
It sounds warmer. The album sounds warmer.
More heartfelt.
CD sounds cold. I will shiver when I say it. So from the warm, fuzzy album, Just Another Day in Hell.
Okay.
Why don't we play the title track?
All right. What's the story behind that one? How'd you come up with that song?
Well, I actually wrote that. I was having a rough night. in a hotel or a motel. I hardly ever have money for a hotel. Motel hell. It was a little flea bag motel. And just me and a six-pack of beer and my guitar, and this sucker just kind of came out and became the title track for the album, Just Another Day in Hell.
All right. Well, I'm going to play it, and I want to thank you for being on my show. It means a lot to me, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
It means a lot to me. Thank you so much, Donnie, for having me, and let's talk again.
All right. Well, let's do this.
Just another day.
But I'm here to tell you, I said, I'm here to tell you. The devil has been working overtime, my friend. I said, the devil has been working overtime, my friend.
Amen.
He started this morning. He'll be working this evening. When you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning, devil will be getting paid time and a half because he is working overtime.
Amen.
Can I get an amen?
If I could catch train and ride, I left Atlanta with no place to go. Make me a pallet on your floor.
Make me a pallet on your floor. Make me a pallet on your floor. Make it soft, make it low, so my good time can grow. Make me a pallet on your floor.
Good time friends of mine, come all you good time friends of mine. When I had a dollar, you treated me just fine. Where'd you go when I only had a dime?
Make me a pallet on your floor. Make me a pallet on your floor. Make it soft, make it low, so a good gal never know. Make me a pallet on your floor.
Everywhere I see, weary blues are everywhere I see. Blues all around me, they're everywhere I see. Nobody has these blues like me.
Make me a pallet on your floor. Make me a pallet on your floor. Make it soft, make it low, so a good girl will never know. Make me a pallet on your floor.
Weary blues are everywhere I see. Blues all around me, they're everywhere I see. Nobody has these blues like me.
Make me a pallet on your floor. Make me a pallet on your floor. Make it soft, make it low, so a good gal will never know. Make me a pallet on your floor. Make it soft, make it low, so my good time gal will never know. Make me a pallet on your floor.
Brother Tripp, can you feel the spirit that is within? Brother Ryan, can I get an amen? Brother Bob, who is a man of the cloth like myself. Brother Bob, who is a man of the cloth unlike myself. Can I get an amen?
I've been to every bar in my hometown.
Girls like me weren't built to be educated. We were made to have children. That's my ambition, to be a walking, talking baby factory. Legal, of course, and with union labor.
And starting off this set, well, fuck, hold on a second. Before I get in all that, I want to make an apology for a minor error I made last week. I made a mistake, and the band was cool with it, but still, it was embarrassing, and I'm sorry. I want to say I'm sorry to Livestock Davies and the Lowdown Snakes by saying they were from Canada when in fact they're from the UK. So I will announce this set talking like I'm from the UK. How about that? If I ever do it again, may a ball winch cut off me wanker. Fuck, I can't do that. But I'm sorry. Never happen again. So, starting off this set was a nice little bluegrass group from my neck of the woods. They're from Ohio, up in the Tiffin Finley area, and the band is called The Atchison Family. And it was a song called Make a Pallet on Your Floor. It was off their CD Just for Fun. Real good group of guys there. Yes, Lord. Real group. Real good group of guys. And following them was Nick Krause and his Austin Torpedoes. And it was a song called Country Song off the album The Tragic Tale of Kim and Polly Jean. Now, when I first got the CD in the mail, I was thinking, oh no. Because Nick Krause has a... His haircut's kind of... I don't know. It could be kind of stylish. And I was like, oh, could he be pop? But fuck no, he wasn't. He brought his A game on this CD, or album, should I say. And it's off Hano Records. Real good album. I do dig them. And rounding out this set was a group that I don't know how I found them. I found them on MySpace, and I'm so fucking glad I did. They're called 13 to the Gallows, and it was a song called Desert Screams off of their album, Make Your Tracks. And the whole fucking album is awesome. They sell on iTunes and a couple other places, so you can check them out in my top friends. Definitely get it. And that's going to be it for my show, this long fucking show that I am doing here. Yes, Lord. But before I end it, I'm going to do an album review for Hellbound Glory, which seems like they just busted onto the scene with their album Scumbag Country. Which it don't seem like it's been out that long, and it's a fucking great album. But their new album, which is called Old High and New Low, I got one word to describe it. Holy fuck. What an awesome album. I don't know how they fucking topped their last one, but this one, oh, great. From beginning to end. And out of 10 stars, I'd give them a 9.5. And, you know, perfect amount of punk, perfect amount of twang, perfect amount of sorrow and heartbreak and addiction and heroin use. You know, all that. And, We're gonna do Another Bender Might Break Me, and then I'm going to follow that up with Hank Williams Records. And I hope you enjoy it. The whole fucking album's great, and that's gonna be all for episode 32. Now remember, episode 33, I'm gonna have Kyle Turley on. We're gonna talk about the tour, talk about his album, talk a little bit about football, and talk about Hank 3. So get with me at Section 86. Motherfuckers! Woo! That's what I'm talking about, bitches! Yes!
Well, I've been out on a bender since I can't remember. And lately it's starting to show. Well, the lines on my face is showing my age. My mind's beginning to go. Yeah, I quit right now, some way, somehow. Reverse the damage I've done. But I was on to my face. It's far too late to stop a bender. Once it's begun, another bender might. Get out the grave. It'll all desk over. And I woke up the next morning, didn't heed the warnings, went off on a bender once more. Between the pills and the whiskey, it's getting a little risky. One day I'm gonna wind up dead.
Merlot.
Yeah, I've been drinking since I woke up like a drunk coming off 12 months dry. Just doing some boozing, so it makes it easy losing you. Girl, I swear you ain't crossed my mind. I went and I bought a 5-30 vodka and sat down and drank it with Coke. I got it on my own. Hank Williams records turned them up just as lousy with gold. And I'm gonna drink till I black out and start a fight with my landlord. With them Hank Williams records that blaring loud, I swear I don't need you anymore. That landlord knocked upon my door and said, son, out of complaints. Oh,